I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The bow tie, not a look that just anyone can pull off, quite like Kansas City Mayor Sly James. Today, we'll see what all his bow tie can do. We'll talk with the authors of a new children's book starring the mayor and his neckwear. Don't think political a la Winston Churchill. Think a bit more magical, like the time-traveling adventures of the 11th Doctor Who. Then we'll look at where history has left the U.S. presidency. From Thomas Jefferson's vision of a restrained leader, through the changes FDR brought to the office, to the modern-day demands of a commander-in-chief, we'll ask, is it time to rethink the presidency? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. That Kansas City Mayor Sly James' bow tie had magical powers. These powers can transport him back in time and zoom him off to the days when Lewis and Clark explored the Kansas City area, or when Charlie Parker played the sax at 18th and Vine, or when Clara Stover made her candy. Who knew? Asia James and Audrey Masoner have written a new children's book that spells out just what the mayor's bow tie can do. That book, Mayor Sly James and the Magic Bow Tie, A Kansas City Adventure. The authors are here in the studio with me. They are Asia James, who just happens to be the mayor's daughter. Asia, welcome. Good morning.
Hi, thank you.
Audrey Masoner is also here. Audrey, nice to have you.
Hi, thank you.
Well, now, whose idea was it to give Mayor James magical powers through his bow tie? Where did that come from?
It came from a three-hour brainstorming session after we decided that he was going to time travel. It was really the question of how he was going to do that. And we explored a couple different options. And just by chance, as Asia and I were wrapping up our session, it became poignantly obvious in our minds that it had to be something that he was with. With him all the time.
Well, Asia, of course it's bow tie, right?
Of course,
everybody knows him by, right?
Of course. Yeah.
How long has he been wearing bow ties?
Oh, my gosh. I think maybe during his first year elected, I think he switched to a bow tie and just never went back. Either his first or second year, but that's a long time. He's been a bow tie fiend for a while.
So like 10, 15 years ago, was he wearing bow ties?
No.
Yeah.
He mainly just wore normal ties. Like when I see a picture of him now with a normal tie, it's very weird. It doesn't look like him. So it's definitely a trademark.
So why a book here, Audrey? Why do a book?
Well, I think it was something that I had thought about when I attended Rockhurst University, which Mayor James just happens to be an alum of as well.
Right.
And something that was in the back of my mind. And I think as I got to know Asia more and got to know her dad more, I thought, you know, he's really colorful. I mean, he's a character and he's perfect for a children's book. So I asked her, would your dad mind? And I think he was amicable. I don't know if he thought we'd get it finished, but he was certainly amicable to it. So we took the idea and ran with it.
I was going to say, what did dad think of the concept, Asia?
I think he thought it was pretty cool. At first, it was him getting a dog, and we changed the concept a few times
getting
on him.
A dog. So, yeah. That's not good enough.
Yeah. Right? Well, this is way better now. Yeah. But I think he liked it. I think he just wanted to make sure he didn't look too silly in the book, which he looks great in the book.
No, he doesn't look too silly.
I think he was really excited about it. And like she said, I don't know if he actually thought we would ever get it done, but we did pretty quickly, too.
You know, the book begins with the mayor on the roof of City Hall and this porch, if you will, that has this absolutely stunning view of the city. I've been up there a couple of times. Describe that place to us.
Yeah, it's, floor two above his office and a 360 view of Kansas City.
And you can walk around.
You can literally see everything from up there. And it's probably one of the coolest views in Kansas City. So I'm sure he goes up there a lot to look at the view and relax a little bit. So
and
that's
decompress
definitely,
probably.
It was a perfect starting place.
I actually have not been up there.
Yeah.
I only been up to the mayor's office. I haven't been all the way up to the top.
You've been up there, Asia?
I have. We went up there on the day he was sworn in. But that's the first time. So that's the only time I've been up there.
Do you know, is that a favorite place for him? Does he like to hang out there?
I don't know how often he gets to go up there. Hopefully he gets to go up there a couple times a week.
Because this time of year it'd be kind of cold.
Yeah, it'd be a little cold and windy, but he loves that view. And I think it's like honestly, I wish more people could see it. It's one of the best views in Kansas City.
Yeah. Audrey, what was it? How tough was it to come up with the historical moments in which you place the mayor as you go through this book?
It was pretty hard. And I think weeding it out to which ones we really wanted to highlight was pretty difficult, too. We actually started with an alphabetized list. So we started with the alphabet and we listed things, events, people, all through the alphabet, and that's how our list started. Mm-hmm. So then as we started to formulate the list, we pinpointed around some different hops in time that made sense to us and tried to highlight the full spectrum of from beginning to now, really, for the city, and picked the most, you know, the most relevant in our minds.
Asia, which one's your favorite?
Oh, that's hard. I really like the barbecue chapter, the barbecue page, because mm-hmm. I didn't know what the first barbecue was, and my dad loves barbecue so much. But then I also really love the World Series, the most recent World Series win, because we were there, and it was cool, and it's cool to see it in the book. And
yes.
It's a shorter trip back in time, but still a little memory. So,
now, just for the record, there is a little bit of a theme of food in this book, which, not to say your dad likes food too much,
oh,
but
does.
It sort of goes in the book, though.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah. Kansas City's got great food, so why not?
Audrey, what's your favorite moment in the book, historical event you guys spotlight here?
Mine is actually one that we had to go back in the second phase of writing, which was the Children's Mercy page.
Yeah,
we had not featured our original layout had not featured any female figures, and so completely unintentional, just how things worked out, we went back to the drawing board and found both Clara Stover and the sisters that started Children's Mercy, and I thought that was a really neat vignette, because you know the mayor's sick and they help him, and it was one that we added that turned out really nice.
Yeah, well, Adrian, do you want to pick out one of the chapters, maybe read it to us, because they're not obviously not very long, and in the meantime, I'll just remind our listeners that are listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking this morning with the two authors of a new children's book, Mayor Sly and the Magic Bow Tie, A Kansas City Adventure. It's out just in time for Christmas. The authors are Asia James, who's the mayor's daughter, and Audrey Masoner, who have put this book together. And which chapter have you picked there?
My favorite one, the barbecue.
Okay,
page here.
Fire away.
All right. Mayor Sly found himself in a nightclub at 18th and Vine listening to Charlie Bird Parker playing the saxophone. The mayor loved the jazz bebop sound, but he was hungry. Outside, there was a mouth-watering smell. Mayor Sly left the club and entered an old trolley barn. "Welcome, I'm Henry Perry," a man said, serving a plate of delicious smoked meat and ribs. The mayor couldn't believe it. "You are the father of Kansas City barbecue," he said. "Haha, I don't know about that," Mr. Perry said. "Enjoy. If you want more, ask that fellow over there who works for me. His name is Arthur Bryant." "Thank you," Mayor Sly said, but his bow tie started spinning and glowing again. "This is bad timing. I didn't even get to finish one rib."
That would not be a good thing,
no,
would it? No, that's not good
no.
at all. Yeah. I didn't realize that the man, Harry Perry, what's his name?
Henry Perry.
Henry Perry
yeah.
was the founder of Kansas City Barbecue. I thought it was like Arthur Bryant or
nope.
somebody.
Nope.
Yeah,
Arthur
well,
Bryant
Arthur Bryant's would, I guess, be the first one that is still around, but Henry Perry started that.
He did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
the bottom line here, Audrey, is this is a really neat way to connect a local figure with our local history and make a direct connection right?
Absolutely. And I think the book does a great job teaching to children, but then I think it transcends to adults as well. It includes a mostly full appendix of Kansas City events and places that I think everyone has a chance to learn a little bit more about Kansas City.
Mm-hmm. Were there events that you weren't aware of as you launched into this book?
I think I was aware of most of the events. I think there was probably, I didn't realize that Clara Stover actually ran Russell Stover's for 6 years. She was the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. There was a lot of detail that I think that I learned that I wasn't aware of.
Yeah. How about you, Asia? Were there moments that were new to you?
I think there were definitely little details that were new to me. The barbecue one is a small one that I didn't know about, but there's a lot more like really, really historical stuff that's in here that I didn't know some of the details, and I didn't know all of the people that were involved in it and how the history of that still affects us today and mm-hmm. is still in our everyday lives. So I think that was the coolest part, is getting to put all the pieces together and really learn about a city that I've grown up in that I didn't even know all these things about.
How did you go about doing your research? Where'd you go to get the information?
We kind of did everything. We had a historian that helped us a little bit. We had a lot of people doing some fact checks, because the last thing we wanted was to get a bunch of stuff wrong
correct,
in the book.
Yes, and, yes.
You're the mayor's daughter. You can't
right.
be making mistakes in here, Asia. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So we did a lot of research ourselves, and then, with the different locations, like the Liberty Memorial and places like that, we would check with their
contacts there.
Yeah, make sure everything was correct.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
People pretty helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. And so is Google. The websites for each one of a lot of these locations helped preliminary research for us to kind of formulate timeframes, different things that happened at certain events. We wanted to try to validate. So that was where we really started.
You know, a lot of people think it's really easy writing a children's book. I mean, there are not a lot of words and, there's just a lot of pictures. And over the years, having had any number of children's authors in here, you've already shaken your head like it's not easy. I've learned, and I can begin to imagine, it's a much more difficult than it appears. Why is it that way?
You tend to forget how to write to a seven to eight-year-old child.
Yes.
So I think when we were writing the book, we were very loquacious with our writing and our words, and we had to parse it back in order to be at the reading level for a 7 or 8 year old child.
How did you put yourself in that mindset?
Less words, and we did have some help from a collaborator that helped us, take things down to a second, third grade reading level as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it required some editing and a lot of input from others as far as what content was relevant, what to pick up on in what we had written.
Did Dad read you a lot of children's books when you were a kid? Was reading something you guys did? Because reading has been such a big initiative of his as mayor.
Yeah, he did. He did read us a lot. I'm like really bad at remembering what books he read us, but I remember books that I read. It's mainly like Amelia Bedelia and stuff like that. But I didn't ever have, like a Kansas City book. That wasn't really a huge thing when I was growing up, was the Kansas City book. Huge Kansas City pride wasn't really there yet. So now mm-hmm. there's all these Kansas City books, and I think it's even better for kids growing up in Kansas City because you get to learn about it and have the pride read to you from when you were a baby.
How much is he going to miss being mayor?
He'll miss it a lot.
He says a year and a half to go,
but still,
we're sort of seeing the end now.
Yeah, here. It's definitely a topic that we're talking about a lot lately because he does have a little bit of time left, but he's going to miss it. He loves Kansas City, but he's going to still – stay active in everything, and he's not going anywhere. He's staying in Kansas City, obviously. So
right.
He'll miss it a lot, but I think he's excited, and we're all excited to see what he does next and where he goes, because he's going to have fun doing whatever he does. So that's for sure.
It's a hard job, isn't it?
It is. I'm excited for him to have a little less stress on his plate and maybe mm-hmm. get to relax a little bit more. But knowing him, he'll pick something else and hit the ground running on that, too. So.
I should point out that our authors will be at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library for an event at 6:30 tonight, where they'll talk about their book, Mayor Sly and the Magic Bow Tie, A Kansas City Adventure. And what's going to happen tonight? You guys going to read a little bit?
We are going to do a signing, and we are going to read the book. Asia, myself, and her dad, we're all three going to read it.
Well, the mayor's going to be there himself.
He is going to be there himself. He gets to read his portion of the book, and then we're going to have some interactive fun with the little vignettes. There's going to be some special guests that come along.
Oh, that's great. That's 6:30 tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Plaza branch. The book again, Mayor Sly and the Magic Bow Tie, A Kansas City Adventure. The authors Asia James and Audrey Masoner. Thanks so much for your time. Good
Thank
luck
you.
With the book, guys.
Thank Thanks. You so much.
Okay, you bet. Time for a break. We'll talk about When we come back, we'll talk about the presidency, and has the job become too big for any one human to handle? We'll find out. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, the story of two men who didn't intend to be activists yet ended up fighting for marriage equality in the reddest of states, that's Texas. Then, while the House and Senate's tax plans are being reconciled by Congress, we'll find out what changes could be in store for you. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the presidency of today is not what Thomas Jefferson once envisioned, not even close. It's gotten too big, too powerful, too all-reaching, our guest says. The growth of the job began with our first president, George Washington. All this is a problem. Modern presidents head into the job with outsized and unrealistic expectations. So often, outside forces come to bear, and they throw presidents off stride. Jeremy Suri is the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. He's a professor of history and holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs at the University of Texas. He joins us now from the studios of KUT in Austin. And Jeremy, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me on, Steve.
You begin this book by saying that the election of Donald Trump as president is the final fall of the founding fathers' presidency, the antithesis of what they expected for the office. Why is Donald Trump the antithesis of what the founders expected for this very important job?
Oh, for so many reasons, Steve.
Yes.
The biggest ones are actually historical. They're not even about Donald Trump's personality. The founding fathers expected the presidency to be an important office, but not to be an all-powerful office. Nor did they expect that Americans would look to the presidency to solve every problem or deal with every anger or resentment that they had. It was to be a modest office, an office that emphasized virtue, and an office that emphasized unity, bringing the country together. The founding fathers expected that presidents would not belong to a party, and they certainly believed presidents would not rile up crowds, but instead calm people down. Huh. And we've reached a point where the presidency does just the opposite of all those things.
I was going to say, one of your central points here is that the presidency has expanded so far beyond what the founders envisioned. How so?
Well, it's expanded for a variety of reasons that have nothing to do with any individual. My book profiles a number of transformative presidents, but the point is to show how each generation, from Washington to Jackson to Lincoln to the Roosevelts to Ronald Reagan, reacted to circumstances. And in these circumstances, as a growing country in a very unsafe world, presidents with every generation took on more power, and for a time that allowed them to achieve more. But my argument is that after World War II, and this is particularly evident with Kennedy, Johnson, Reagan, and others, as presidents took on more power, the responsibility limited their effectiveness, and they became too powerful, which meant they were less effective and in some ways created more problems for our country than they solved.
All right, how can a president be too powerful and then that wind up hurting their progress, undermining what they had hoped to achieve?
That's a great question. It's the old Greek tragedy. The growth of power helps for a time, but after a while, the power undermines the purposes for which the power was gained. And what's happened with presidents is that they're doing so many things, and I try to show this in the book in particular by focusing on their calendars and how they spend their time, that they're doing so many things they don't do anything well. Look at our foreign policy, for example. We're the most powerful military, economic, and political actor in the world. We still are. And it's been a long time since we had a foreign policy success, right? It's because we're doing too many things in too many places. It's mediocrity across the board. That's become part of our public culture. And presidents reinforce that by pretending that they have a one-line answer to every problem.
This idea, that they have too much on their plates. What can you tell by looking at their daily schedules? What leaped out at you? I mean, is it really broken up into, 5, 10, 15-minute chunks throughout the whole day?
Absolutely. Three things jump out at me from the calendars. I spent a lot of time with them, and I was really pleased we were able to show some pictures of these calendars in the book. First thing that jumps out is presidents have no time to think. They're constantly running. They're reacting to things. Second, and this relates to the first point, they're not setting their own agenda. Take the North Korean crisis right now. Who's making American policy in North Korea? Is it the White House or is it Kim Jong-un? Mm-hmm. It's Kim Jong-un because we're reacting every day to one more thing that he does. And then the third thing that jumps out in the calendars is how little contact presidents have now with American citizens. They are in a bubble. Mm. They are spending all their time with staff members, and they lose touch. Just think about this. If you're president for 4 or 8 years, you never stop at a red light. You never go into a grocery store. You don't have an unscripted conversation. It was not that way 40 years ago. But now they are systematically out of touch. And then we're surprised when they don't understand the American people.
But you get the sense, though, that given the 24-hour news cycle, and we'll talk about that in a few moments, and given the trajectory of American history when it comes to the presidency, that the genie is sort of out of the bottle now. Can you possibly stuff it back in?
No, I don't think we can. And I wrote this history of the presidency not because I want us to go back to the 18th century. We can't. But I think we need to reinvent the office. Mm. And the genius of our greatest leaders, our Washingtons, our Lincolns, our Theodore and Franklin Roosevelts, and to some extent even Ronald Reagan, is that they did reinvent the office. And we need a new generation of institutional reform, not blowing things up, because blowing things up just keeps all the processes we've talked about, all the problems in place. We need a new kind of office. And in the business world, Steve, I think business leaders have been talking about this for a few decades and have done a lot of work to reimagine what a CEO looks like. Mm-hmm. It's probably time we reimagine what a president looks like.
I'm wondering, you know, this problem of having too many things on their plates as they go through their years in the White House. You know, just take that part of it then, Jeremy. What would you do to deal with that aspect and getting corralling this notion of too much at any on any one plate on any one day?
It's a great question, Steve. I think we have to have less of a debate about big or small government and more of a debate about good government. What are the 3, 4, 5 priorities for our country? And how can we elect the right person to focus on those priorities? And those might be areas where the president has to do more than he's ever done before, but that would mean not getting involved in other things that might make political sense but don't make sense for the national interest. I'll be very clear about this. I think most of the cultural issues that presidents spend a lot of time arguing about and giving speeches about, presidents really don't have much control over that. No. Who goes to which bathroom should not be a presidential issue. Abortion should not be a presidential issue. But it does seem to me having an environment with oxygen we can breathe and water we can drink, that probably should be a presidential priority.
I bet if you got our former presidents into a room and they just listened to the last minute of what you just said, Jeremy, I bet they would all nod their heads and say, you know, I bet you're right. I think I've heard Obama, President Obama, say exactly the same thing.
I agree. And I think that's part of my point in the book, Steve, is it's not that we've had bad men in office. I can only really comment based on fact and research on the 44 presidents who have been in office and left. I'm a historian. And those 44 have all tried to do the job. And they all found that the job wore them down, especially the last 10 presidents or so. And the job changed them more than they changed the job, which is why I think we need structural reform. It's not just about the individual.
I think you write in here, too, that both Presidents Clinton and Obama went into office determined to not allow the office to run them, but they were going to run the office. And yet you point out they still fell short.
They did, because in part, as talented as they were, they didn't understand just how deep this problem is. I mean, these are two men who got to where they are as most successful politicians and business people do by just outworking everyone. And once you reach the presidency, outworking people, it only digs you deeper. It's really about focus and priorities. And they had trouble. And of course they had trouble, because to get elected in our society to raise money, you have to offer things to almost every group. And that becomes the opposite of leadership. That becomes a problem of overstretch.
We're talking about the American presidency, and has the job gotten too big? You're welcome to join our conversation. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Our guest, Jeremy Suri, he's the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. You know, which president most seized on that potential for power and expanding the reach of the office, Jeremy? I mean, because most people would assume it was FDR. You describe President Roosevelt as the culmination of 150 years of growth in the reach of the presidency.
I think the two figures who did this best of all, with the best strategy and the most effectiveness, were Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt. Mm. In Abraham Lincoln's case, it's turning the presidency from a dispassionate father figure that Washington was into really a CEO, really someone with a business development plan. Lincoln, as I talk about in the book, as a poor white man from the frontier, wants the presidency to offer opportunity for white men like himself, which is why he opposes slavery, which brings down the wages of people like Lincoln. And so Lincoln's the one who has a plan for an intercontinental railroad, a plan to create public universities, the Morrill Land Grant, a plan to give land to immigrants who will work the land even if they're not citizens. That's the Homestead Act. He creates our modern capitalist economy and the single largest integrated market in the world. And then Franklin Roosevelt expands the presidency one more time over to help those who have been left behind, to help those who are suffering in this capitalist economy. As I describe in the book, I think Roosevelt's experience with polio, coming from such a privileged background, but seeing and spending 6 years in Warm Springs, Georgia, with some of the most destitute Americans, seeing how much they suffered, gave him a sympathy and a sense of mission that the presidency had to push forth economic development, but also help those who were left behind.
So why was he able to master the job of president? I'm talking about FDR, whereas those who largely came after him, you're saying, could not.
Right. It's a great question. People often ask me when I'm talking about the book this question because, of course, FDR had some pretty big things to do. He had to deal with the Depression and then World War II. So it's not like he it's not like the office was tiny when FDR was there.
Right.
I think there were two recipes to his success, which are actually the recipes that also set us up for failure. One, FDR had an extraordinary ability to still stay in contact with the American people. Eleanor Roosevelt helped him with this enormously. But he used the office to bring people in of all different backgrounds. He couldn't go to see them, but he brought them to him. And his social skills, his emotional intelligence, we would call it today, was at such a high level. And then the second issue is, even though there were a lot of big things on his plate, he was able to group them together into very simple categories and emphasize the national interest when thinking about job growth and when thinking about fighting fascism. He didn't get caught up in special interest politics to the same extent that his successors would. He succeeded so greatly that he created this office with growing expectations at home and abroad. FDR is really the first president of the world. And that means more and more groups make demands on the office. And so when John F. Kennedy tries to recreate, as he did, what Roosevelt does, he's so much busier, he can't do it. Here's just one way of thinking about it. For Roosevelt, there are about 40 countries in the world. Maybe 6 or 8 really matter to him. For Kennedy, there are more than 140 countries where he has to worry about the spread of communism. So just think of the scale, the difference in scale that Kennedy has versus Roosevelt. That's just 20 years difference.
And also the notion of money in politics, very different in FDR's time than it is today, obviously.
Yes, that's part of the issue. As the office grows and government is doing more, more people develop economic interests surrounding different government activities, and more money gets allocated to that. And also, as the U.S. becomes more prosperous, there are more people with money to spend on politics. So again, we're a victim of our success.
Has the American presidency become the ultimate impossible job? That's our topic. 816-235-2888 is our number. Let's go to Deborah from Kansas City, Missouri. Deborah, good morning.
Good morning. I was just wondering if the guest could speak to a couple of things. Number one, would it take a constitutional amendment to change some of the responsibilities of the vice president? Because at this point, according to the Constitution, he really only has two responsibilities. And additionally, could he also talk about how technology has changed the office of the presidency?
Yeah. Yeah. Both great questions. Deborah, thanks very much.
Yeah, terrific questions from Deborah. First, certainly some of the bigger changes that I discuss at the end of the book, such as creating a prime minister, perhaps, would require constitutional change. But there are a lot of things that can be done within our constitutional structure now. In fact, there are many ways in which we're not following the Constitution. Let's take war making, for example. The Constitution is very clear that the power to make war lies with Congress, not the president. But yet, the last time we declared war was December 1941. So by those terms, we haven't been at war since then. And this is particularly true when we think about nuclear weapons today. There were good reasons, Deborah, why during the Cold War, and I've written about this, others have too, why we wanted the president to be able to launch a quick response if the Soviets launched their nukes at us. But now there's no reason for that. I mean, even if North Korea used a small nuclear weapon, it would be incredibly damaging, but there's no reason we'd have to rush. So part of what I would argue is we should just enforce the Constitution, which would limit some of the excessive powers presidents have taken on. And maybe the vice president can play more of a role, but I think other members of Congress can play more of a role. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the Speaker of the House should be chosen only by the majority party. Many states, including Texas, have their Speaker of the House chosen by both parties. Think how different
it would be. What a concept that is. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Wow. Yeah.
But that would allow for someone to play more of a bipartisan role with legislation, which would help the executive produce more moderate policies to serve the country. This comes to Deborah's second point about technology. I think the technology of our time, like most technologies, doesn't produce a particular political outcome. It's how it's been used. Mm-hmm. And it has been captured by partisan interest, captured by moneyed interest, and quite frankly, captured by politicians who are more interested in power than the national interest. And reforming the office would let us use technology more for the national interest than for partisan purposes.
You know, one of the issues in our politics, I think, maybe it's one of our issues with human nature, you know, Jeremy, is this idea that no one ever wants to voluntarily give up power because it leaves you in a lesser position than you were before. And that's what you're suggesting here on some levels. And that's a tough nut to crack, isn't it?
It certainly is. And the founders said this themselves. Federalist Papers, Madison and Hamilton and Jay's writings are filled with this. I think it's Madison who says, if men were angels, we would not need government. But men are not angels and never will be angels. Mm-hmm. So the genius of the founders was not that they created a blueprint we can follow today. That's nonsense. It's more that they created some principles that are valuable principles that we can return our minds to when we think about governance. And one of the first principles they had was a principle of checks and balances. Mm-hmm. And part of what I'm arguing is that the presidency has become overly bloated in its power, and we need to bring it back down to size, and that would actually help the leadership purposes of presidents.
You know, I always, whenever we have these conversations on this show, I always get this idea in my head, boy, it would be so fascinating to get Washington and Jefferson and Madison and a few others, you know, if they could possibly come back today and offer some guidance, wouldn't that be a moment? You would just die to know what they would say about what we're doing today and how we're doing it.
Absolutely. But, you know, the thing is, Steve, they would not recognize our country today. Hmm. And some of that is good. They expected our country to evolve. Jefferson's dream was that we would become a democracy like one that had never existed before and that they themselves couldn't imagine. So some of that is good. But on the other hand, I think three things would strike them, many of these things you've already mentioned, Steve. First, money. They saw politics and democracy as a check on moneyed interests. Second, nepotism. One of my favorite lines comes from Thomas Paine in Common Sense. He says, the son of a king is no more likely to be a genius than the son of a baker. And in fact, the king's son is more often a fool. The founders were profoundly anti-nepotistic.
Yeah.
And third, they believed politics was a high calling for the most virtuous, meritorious people. That's why George Washington was their first president. And boy, have we strayed from that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of George Washington, you point out and you mentioned here that the process of expanding the authority of the office began with George Washington. What did he do?
Well, Washington was given this office or elected to this office under Article 2 of the Constitution. That's pretty vague. And the things that he did were to expand the power of the office to unify the country. He was profoundly concerned, as were most of the writers of the Constitution, that these 13 states and the others that were becoming states that had led the revolution were now falling apart, pulling in different directions, competing against one another. And so Washington used the office to unify people. One of the biggest things he did was, following Hamilton's economic plan, create a single capital market where the federal government took over the debt of the states and really managed capital within the United States. He also invested in roads. He called for the creation of a national university. Hmm. And then during the Whiskey Rebellion, he was the first and last president to lead troops directly into battle against people in western Pennsylvania who didn't want to pay their taxes. So some things are always the same in our society.
Right, right. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. We're talking about the size and scope of the American presidency and how it's gotten simply too large. Let's go back to some phone calls. And Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri. Kevin, you're on Up to Date.
Hi there. Good morning. No doubt a great book. I honestly think I'll get it and read it. But frankly, I've always been a political science student from college on. And In the 70s, we studied, you know, the imperial presidency. And even then, Congress, you know, we learned how Congress kept abdicating and keeps abdicating power and powers to the president. And yet they bemoan the fact that either they're powerless or that he's too powerful. And it becomes kind of this ridiculous, hypocritical situation, but they keep doing it. And I would love to hear your guests' input on that.
Well, Kevin, you're absolutely right, and my book is in direct dialogue with Arthur Schlesinger's great book from the early 70s on the imperial presidency,
right,
which is really a book written in the shadow of Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
My book was actually completed before Donald Trump was elected. There's an epilogue I added after the election, but this was actually a book I was writing while Obama was president, and my argument draws on the notion of the imperial presidency but takes it a step further to say that this imperial presidency actually undermines itself. And I think the solutions, and this is why I'm optimistic, are staring us right in the face. It is, as you say, are demanding that other institutions step forward and do their job, in particular Congress, but also that the American people voice an alternative vision of the kind of leadership they want. And here's why I'm optimistic. The young people who I work with, especially the 400 or so undergraduates I teach every semester,
mm-hmm.
They get this. They don't view leaders in the same way that a prior generation did. They don't think the president's going to get them a job or solve their problems, but yet they think we need someone who will unify the country, yet they think we need someone who will focus on environmental issues. So we as voters need to make our voices heard, and the real problem right now is that's not happening.
I hope that helps, Kevin. Thank you. Yeah. You know, you write that John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Ronald Reagan all fell tragically, your word, into a pattern of excess, isolation, and decline, just as Jefferson had once predicted. Describe that for us. How do they fall into a pattern of excess, isolation, and decline?
Well, Jefferson's fear, having read a lot and watched the experience of kings and prime ministers,
right,
in Europe, was that power would create isolation, distorted, what he viewed as degenerate practices. And that happened with Kennedy, Johnson, Reagan, and so many others. These were good men, by the way, men of integrity, all three of these men. But what happened was, being such a powerful country with so many demands, they found themselves using their power often in thoughtless ways. And then when they had made mistakes, they found themselves using more power to pursue more mistaken policies rather than admitting that they had made a mistake in stepping back. So that's the story of Vietnam for
mm-hmm.
Kennedy and Johnson. It's a very sad historical insight that once you've sent troops to die for the wrong war, as John Kerry said, it's easier to send more to die rather than to admit your mistake. Ronald Reagan fell into this in the Middle East. He got involved there, sending troops to Lebanon, I'm sure many of your listeners remember,
sure,
because he wanted to actually deal with the escalated violence that was occurring, and ended up getting more deeply involved in the region and becoming the target of terrorism. And then we got deeper and deeper, and that's brought us in part to where we are today. So this is the issue, that power often leads us to undertake actions that undermine our interests, and once we do that, our inclination is to use more power rather than step back and say, you know, we made a mistake, let's rethink this. And that's the story, particularly since September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
Look at all the wars we fought and look how little we've accomplished.
Jeremy Suri is my guest. His book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. Our number here again, 816-235-2888. Lisa from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd heard your guest mention Prime Minister Mao, and I wondered if he could speak a little more about that and if he thinks that's a possible option for in U.S. government.
The Prime Minister model, Jeremy.
Well, I'm glad Lisa brought that up. It's something I've been talking a lot about. The New York Times sort of pulled this out for my book also. One of the things I learned doing this research that I hadn't known before, I should have, is that even though we invent modern democracy in the 18th century and so many other countries follow our model, today we're a loner in that all of these other countries, every one of them, Germany, France, India, they've all adopted a system where they have a president and a prime minister. We're the only ones that have stuck with this 18th century notion of a a unified executive. How would this work? I think a prime minister could have primary authority over legislation and Congress and encourage Congress to be more active and more involved, whereas the president could focus more on foreign policy issues and head of state issues. And one of the things I try to show in the calendars that I have images of in the book is presidents spend a lot of time doing things that are head of state responsibilities, meeting with foreign diplomats, meeting with sports teams that have won championships, as well as all the foreign policy problems. And over time, they have less and less time for Congress, which is why they don't listen to Congress and why Congress sort of feels hostile toward the executive. Having a prime minister who had primary legislative responsibility, overseeing issues like health care and the tax code, while the president focuses on North Korea and Iraq and Iran, would make a lot more sense. That's what other countries do.
You say you were surprised that despite these enormous duties these men have had to deal with, you were surprised to find out how much time presidents devote to mediating petty conflicts, you call them. What's an example of that?
Well, the example everyone points to is Jimmy Carter.
The tennis courts, right?
The tennis courts,
yes,
exactly. See, everyone knows the tennis
courts. Absolutely. What was he doing? Yeah. Yeah.
I'll give you a more specific example with Ronald Reagan. The Reagan chapter for me was really interesting to write because I have to say it, I'm not necessarily a huge fan of Reagan. But first of all, Reagan was a man of integrity, profound integrity, a man who took his responsibilities very seriously. And he also didn't want to be a micromanager. Here's the problem he ran into, though. His assistants were infighting. And they were fighting because the responsibilities of our country were so great, and it wasn't clear who was to oversee them. So Al Haig famously thought he was in charge of foreign policy, mm-hmm. not the president of the United States. Cap Weinberger at the Defense Department thought he was in charge, and Reagan had to spend a lot of time actually mediating between them. In one famous moment, Al Haig refuses to sign a letter that the president wants to write to the Soviet leaders. So Reagan says, okay, Al, you send your letter, I'll send my letter. And so this infighting, which is actually a function of not only more responsibility, but more people, you multiply the number of staff members and you multiply the conflicts. You don't actually create a smoother process.
Talk about the pace of the job, because you spend some time dealing with that in here. What's causing this need for speedier decision making that would have just been appalling to Thomas Jefferson?
Well, some of it is what you mentioned before, Steve, the 24-hour news cycle.
And how responsible is the media for this? Yeah.
Well, I tend to believe that the media is doing their job. Now, there are some media that see their job as spreading lies, and that's a different story. But I think the fast pace of our news is because the world, things are happening around the world all the time, and obviously citizens at different moments in different places want to be informed. The issue is more whether that is driving the president or the president is driving the news cycle, and too often presidents find the news cycle is driving them. The solution to this problem is not to stonewall or attack the media. The solution to this problem is to have a narrative, have a story of your own, have a set of interests that you're pursuing, and articulate them. Too many presidents, I try to show, get so caught up in responding every minute that they lose sight of their larger story. They lose sight of what they're about. And that's their fault, not the media's.
I want to read a little bit from the book. You also contend that we are electing leaders who simply aren't prepared for the gravity of the office and its responsibilities. The trick here is that the president is more than a CEO or a general or a party leader. He's closer to a mythological figure expected to rise above normal human limitations and manage a constant barrage of local and international problems. And they must do the job at a pace that would crush mere mortals. That gets at your title here, right? I mean, the impossible presidency. And you believe what? Point blank, it's now impossible?
I do. I think if tomorrow, Steve, the most perfect, virtuous, smart management guru person showed up to be president, that person would do a better job than this guy right now, but that person would still have many of the same problems, that this is inhuman, and we need to rethink that. And that's a natural opportunity for renewal of our democracy. Why should an institution that was created in the 18th century, that's gone through only a few periods of reform, why should it be the right institution for the 21st century? Would anyone want to run a business with 18th century institutions mm-hmm. or a university? Mm-hmm. It might be time to rethink this in the interests of democracy.
Some people say it's time for another constitutional convention, which is an intriguing idea, But boy, you wonder where that might lead, though, right?
Yeah, I'm a believer in emergent institutional change, or another way of putting that, and I wrote an earlier book on the 60s, so I'm deeply influenced by this. I believe in the long march through the institutions. You reform institutions by getting good people in who see the need to change the institutions and work from the inside to change them. And there's a lot of room within our Constitution for that without even necessarily having to amend it. We've already talked about that, changing the relationship between Congress and the executive, changing the kinds of issues the president focuses on. A new president could decide that there really are four or five priorities and that he or she is going to focus on them. And you know what? If they don't get reelected, that's fine, too.
Yeah, maybe that's the trick here, this notion that the expectation for greatness in as seen through the eyes of history is that the minimum standard is a president has to win a second term. And maybe that's one thing that might change to get us over a hump here.
I agree 100%. I think you hit the nail on the head, Steve. I often remind audiences that two people who always show up at the top of the list of great presidents only had one term. In fact, one of them had less than one term. I'm talking about Lincoln and Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy served 1,000 days or so, 3 years. And Lincoln was elected a second time, but only served less than month of his second term.
Yeah.
So it's not time in office. It's accomplishments that matter.
To continue your point, you write this: despite the crushing intensity, the president is expected to be ever ready for crises, yet strategically minded, deeply connected to ordinary citizens, but independent of special interests, a manager of democratic institutions, and a fearless commander of lethal force. Although no human being can do all those things expected of the president, each individual elected to this mighty office must claim that he can. Like the power of the Greek gods, the promise of the presidency always exceeds what is possible. That's a great line.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I think it's true. And I think it explains in part why there's such distrust in government now, because we've created expectations no one can meet. And then opponents of those in power say, you see, they're corrupt, or you see, the person lied to you. In reality, we're setting ourselves up to fail.
Ultimately, you say the presidency is grueling, it's lonely, and a job that creates self-doubt of even the most confident presidents. I think the New York Times chronicled some of that this weekend in a long story on President
Yes.
Trump. Talk to me about how lonely this job can be.
Well, it's an incredibly lonely job. And again, the Greeks predicted this. It's in Sophocles and others, right, that when you have this much power, no one is a confidant or friend. Everyone wants something from you. And the responsibilities never end. You're so powerful that no matter what happens anywhere, you're expected to have a solution to it. And that ends up driving you. And what we've seen, and what the New York Times pointed out in this long, I thought, really very well-reported piece this weekend, is how profoundly unhappy this president is. And you know what? Almost every president is profoundly unhappy in office for this reason. They have no friends. They have too many responsibilities. They don't get credit for any accomplishments, and they get all the blame for all the problems. And that's not simply because of the media. That's because of the expectations they themselves have created by running for office.
Yeah, right. Jeremy Suri is my guest. He's the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. And, Jeremy, I really enjoyed having you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Those were great questions, Steve.
All the best.
Thank you.
You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, you can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, we'll hear the story of a pair of accidental activists for marriage equality. And we'll take a look at the tax bill and what it might mean for you. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.